The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love, courage, truth. Glenn Beck.
Well, our FBI director, Andrew McCabe, was fired over the weekend, and that was the big storm. He was set to receive top-tier retirement benefits by officially retiring on Sunday, but the axe came down just hours before. Now, before I read McCabe's official response, I think it's beneficial to clarify the difference between a victim and someone who's guilty of something. If someone robs a gas station, we don't penalize the worker that just got robbed. We penalize the guy wearing the ski mask. Right? It's pretty simple. But both McCabe and the media can't seem to get this one right. So here's McCabe's official response. Here is the reality. I'm being singled out and treated this way because of the role I played, the actions I took, and the events I witnessed in the aftermath of the firing of James Comey. The OIG's focus on me and this report became part of an unprecedented effort by the administration, driven by the president himself, to remove me from my position, destroy my reputation, and possibly strip me of a pension that I worked 21 years to earn. My gosh, he's a victim. The Department of Justice Inspector General is clearly just a, you know, Trumpian stooge helping the president wage war on the FBI. Trump is hiding all of his collusion. Get him! Because that's the only explanation here, right? Unless you take a step back and go, now, wait a minute, let me look at all of the facts. McCabe isn't the victim here. The inspector general found evidence that McCabe was leaking information to the press, and then he lied about it to the inspector general's office under oath. The OIG, the Office of Inspector General, then contacted the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility, which is basically a fancy name for HR. Now, I want you to know that this particular HR department is not known for doing anything about anybody. They generally don't recommend anything harsh. They were informed about what McCabe had been doing. To reiterate, the charges are leaking information and lying under oath. So what did this HR department do? They recommended fire him. All right, so you have the OIG and the FBI now saying fire him. Losing his job should be the least of McCabe's worries. He may be looking at perjury charges, and if he lied under oath, he should be charged with perjury and perhaps obstruction of justice. So seriously, who's the victim here? I contend it's you. I contend it's the people of the United States. Now, Trump's Department of Justice clearly did this to fire some shots at the FBI, right? I mean, it's collusion. Well, no, actually, Trump had nothing to do with the investigation by the Inspector General. That's the deal with the office, OIG, Office of Inspector General. They're completely neutral. They're taken out of the system. They just overwatch. It was actually requested during the Obama administration by two Democrats. Back then, the scandal wasn't Russia, but who was leaking information on Hillary Clinton? Michael Horowitz was the DOJ Inspector General and an Obama appointee. Democrats figured this is their ace in the hole to find out who was hurting Hillary. Well, now we know who was doing it. But Democrats and the media somehow or another have forgotten how this whole thing started and that they were absolutely thrilled when this investigation began. The Democrats hated the FBI back when all of this began, and they were looking for someone to blame. But now they love the FBI and somehow are trying to find someone to blame the president for an investigation that they called for under the Obama administration and that is being conducted by an Obama appointee. So again, I just have to ask, who is the victim here? The person on the receiving end of the crime? Or the deputy director wearing the ski mask that is now going to take 21 years of pension from you?
It's Monday, March 19th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
You know, do you feel like you get any news, real news, from anybody anymore? Do you feel like you even understand? When you're online, do you feel like you really understand and can trust the stories anymore? I've got to go like to 14 different sources before I trust that I have it down.
Yeah, I'm honestly just bored with it at this point. You know, it's weird. It's not boring in a 1700s, Jane Austen movie way.
Really?
It's boring in the Fast and Furious kind of way. Like, we all know that you go to a Fast and Furious movie and there's going to be a lot of car chases and explosions. And it's not to say that any of those individual things aren't exciting. Mm-hmm. But when you step back, are you excited about a new Fast and Furious movie? It's the same crap. You know everything. You know there's going to be a car that takes off from one bridge, blows up in midair, flips over. The person inside is going to jump out of the car and land somehow in another car on the other bridge and live.
You know what? I think I understand what you're saying, because if you miss one Fast and Furious, you can pick it up at the next one.
You really didn't miss anything.
Right.
And it's like you kind of roll your eyes while you're there, and it's like the media reaction to all of this is always constant massive mega explosions with Vin Diesel level. And, you know, you get that every single day for multiple years, and it just becomes dull. You know, I know it's an explosion, but it's just dull at this point. Every one of these, every day, I feel like we just waste our time. Did Tokyo Drift really change anyone's life? And I think the answer to that is no.
So here's some good news for you. The Women's March is losing membership.
Now, this is really good news.
Members of its own administration, after refusing to distance itself from the noted anti-Semitic Louis Farrakhan. According to the New York Post, the group's social media director, Alyssa Klein, jumped ship last week and condemned the Women's March leadership on her way out, calling Farrakhan a dangerous troll. I think he's more than a dangerous troll. Maybe that's just me, yeah. But I'll take it. Mm-hmm. She suggested the Women's March take those in leadership positions to task for supporting him. She wrote on Twitter, "I respect loyalty, but I do not respect unquestioning loyalty, especially if it means attacking those who are asking legitimate questions, and especially if it means turning a blind eye to the hate spoken about a group of people. Question leaders. Leaders, be open to questions." Wow, that's fantastic. Alyssa Klein is her name. In recent weeks, see if you knew this. In recent weeks, the Women's March lost support of Planned Parenthood. I didn't hear that. Did you hear that everywhere?
I did not
hear that. Perhaps the movement's foremost ally in support of women's rights and smaller state-based branches of the Women's March have broken off from the main entity, citing Tamika Mallory and Linda Sarsour's love for Farrakhan. Now, how is it that the biggest, most powerful... I mean, imagine the Tea Party. The Tea Party broke away from... You know, I don't know. Think of in the height. Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck. Would that have been news?
It may have been mentioned, yeah. It may have been mentioned. Yeah.
It may have been mentioned. So there's some good news there. I will tell you that Dershowitz was on television over the weekend. In fact, let's play the segment where he was talking about the Democrats that are embracing Louis Farrakhan.
I think Keith Ellison has to be fired immediately as deputy chairman of the DNC. Not only has he become close to Farrakhan, but he's lied to the American public about ending his relationship with Farrakhan. We know that he continued to meet with Farrakhan even after he said he no longer met with him. This is the leadership of the Democratic Party. Farrakhan is a bigot. He is far worse than David Duke. Why? Because Farrakhan has a large following. David Duke is a joke. He doesn't have a large following. He has no influence on university campuses. He has no influence with any major segment of the American public. But we see that Farrakhan has continuing influence within the African American community at the very highest levels. That's why he's so much more dangerous. And he ought to be treated the way we treat David Duke. If any Republican dared to meet with David Duke, that would be the end of their career. It should be the end of the career of any Democrat who has any association with this bigot Farrakhan.
So I think this is really, I think this is really important. And I think we need to, I think we all need to decide who we are and where our lines are. You want to always decide, you know, what I'm willing to do before you're asked to do it. You know, you think of the worst case scenarios and like, would I do that? No. So when you get there, you already know the answer. And I thought for a very long time that there were things that we could all agree on. And I still believe this. Stopping sexual harassment and abuse of women, of men, it doesn't matter. Stopping sexual and, quite honestly, mental abuse, physical abuse, any kind of abuse. I can't imagine anyone making a case for that. Standing by and going, you know what? It's not so bad. It is. And we all know that. And that's why the Me Too movement, beside the political aspect of it, has made a real difference. Because we're not those people. We're not, you know, in the 1950s and, you know, Mad Men. We're just not those people. We agree on that. We agree on stopping bigotry against those who are different or choose to live differently. We're not bigots. We don't want to round anybody up. We'll judge people as individuals. Now, this one has gotten slippery. Because we're just replacing one individual with another individual. And that's not the goal. That's not progress. Taking the homosexuals and saying, okay, homosexuals, transgendered, you're now okay, but Christians are bad. No. Okay, we've fixed the race problem. Blacks are cool. Whites are bad. No. Every real American that I know, they know that this is, they know that Martin Luther King was right. Judge people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin, not their sexual identity, or any of that nonsense. What's the content of their character? And as Martin Luther King said, America, it's time you live up to the words that you worship. All men are created equal. All we have to do is live up to it. And there was another category that I really thought that we all agreed on, and that is, you know, I don't think we call Jews vermin. What do you say? That didn't work out well. Hasn't worked out well in the past. Apparently, for the alt-right and for the extreme left, that's a hard one to get their arms around. You have a hard time not saying Jews are vermin. You know, but the rest of America, Democrats and Republicans, I mean, the ones who are actually out in the middle of the country working, they don't have a problem with that. They're not talking about how the Jews control everything. There is no difference between neo-Nazis and Farrakhan. When it comes to the Jews, they agree. And we condemn them because They believe that the black man or the white man is the cause of not all of the problems, because really all of the problems are caused by them dirty Jews. Democrats, this is your challenge, just as the Republicans have theirs. The alt-right hates the Jews. That is the canary in the coal mine. Democrats, the leaders of the Women's March are embracing Farrakhan by just saying, well, I mean, I don't, they obviously hate the Jews. Again, when you see anti-Semitism, you have to get away from it. Or when that canary stops singing, you're next. And we will all be dragged down and die in the darkness of the coal mine. I think we can all agree on Jews aren't vermin. What do you say? Let's make that. Eh, the bar is getting lower and lower every day. What do you say? That's our Monday slogan. Jews are not vermin. They're not the root of all evil. They're not the problem.
It's a high bar to clear for the Women's March. I don't think they can pull that one off.
And it's a hard line to. It's a hard one to clear if you're a neo-Nazi too.
Yeah, it does seem to be that way.
Yeah, so it kind of cuts both ways. Maybe everybody should recognize you either clearly deny that and get away from those people, or you might be part of the problem. You've heard me talk about Blinds.com. They are the best at what they do. Blinds.com is your place for blind, shade, shutters, drapes, anything that you need. In fact, it is the easiest way for you to increase the value of your house by just changing out the curtains, changing out the blinds or the shutters. This is the home improvement that is way less expensive than anything else if you're getting ready to sell your home. Blinds.com. Find out yourself why over 20 million Americans have trusted Blinds.com to upgrade their home, making them the number one online retailer of custom window coverings. Now through the 22nd, when you buy one, you get 50% off of the other one. So you buy one blind, one window of curtains or shutters or drapes, you get 50% off the next window. At blinds.com/Beck. Buy one, get 50% off at blinds.com. That's blinds.com. Rules and restrictions do apply. Blinds.com/Beck.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
So on Friday, we had the director and Dennis Quaid and a lot of the people involved in the movie, I Can Only Imagine. It was expected to open at about $2 million. They were only about $15 million short. It opened in over half of the theaters.
I believe what you mean is less than half.
I'm sorry, yeah. Less than half of the theaters for Black Panther and Tomb Raider. It came in number three. At $17 million, Tomb Raider was $23 million, and Black Panther was $27, $10 million shy. If they would have had all of the theaters, it may have, at least would have been number two.
Yeah, pretty incredible. I mean, that's amazing. And on a $7 million budget, a $17 million first weekend, that's a nice turn.
Where Tomb Raider was $94 million, and it made 23.
Yeah, that's not a good start.
Yeah, not a good start. Not a good start. That's incredible. Wrinkle in Time only made $16 million. Love, Simon, $11 million. Game Night.
Game Night was solid.
Was it?
Yeah, it was very funny. I mean, it's an R-rated comedy with Jason Bateman, but very, very funny.
I like Jason Bateman.
Yeah, he's
funny.
Always solid.
Peter Rabbit. Did you see that?
My kids saw it.
Yeah.
They like everything, so they liked it.
Strangers, Pray at Night, Red Sparrow.
Red Sparrow was pretty solid. It was a little confusing and a little long, but pretty
number
good.
Number nine. I think that was killed by her. I mean, it was
Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah. I think all of her,
oddly, if you've seen it, it was also saved by her.
Was it? Okay. Yes. Death Wish.
Death Wish has got to be, I saw this too, probably the most pro-NRA movie ever made. It's just, there are times where they're just like 2-minute rants about how important it is for you to have a gun to protect yourself because the cops won't show up fast enough. Like it's like you're listening to a talk show in movie form. It's great.
7 days in Entebbe came in at number 13. I saw that last night. That's really good. Really good. Especially if if you're into history, it's a pretty amazing story. 7 days in Entebbe. By the way, we have Jim Caviezel coming up in studio today.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Stu, I know you're very much into the stats of global warming, and there is a new theory now on what caused the snow in Washington, D.C. This is D.C. City Council member Trayon White on the snow in Washington, D.C.
Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man. Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, man. This climate manipulation. And D.C. keep talking about we're a resilient city. And that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate to create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful.
Okay. So that would be the Jews, Jews controlling the climate. Huh. That's a D.C. city council member.
Weren't you just trying to set the high bar?
Yeah.
The
yes,
Jews
I was.
Vermin?
Yes. Well, he didn't say they were vermin.
No.
He just said that the Rothschilds were controlling the weather.
And he's employed by anyone? What is it? A city councilman?
He's a city councilman.
Unreal.
For the District of Columbia.
Well, he took the lid off of that one.
Now, here's a state representative is working, let's see, West Bridgewater. This is up, I believe, in Massachusetts. Her name is Michelle Dubois. And here's what she had to say about a sign that is marking a very famous general and a statue. Go ahead.
Female staffers don't use that entrance because the sign is offensive to them. It's just a little semantics, a little wordplay that some people find very charming and funny, but I find can be hurtful.
Okay.
But that's not what the sign is.
No, you don't know what the sign is. The sign says General Hooker entrance. And apparently famous General Hooker. And so she is saying that she wants the sign taken down because she's offended by the man's name.
Oh my gosh.
General Hooker.
They're not calling her a hooker. She is aware of this?
No, I don't think she's saying she would never use that doorway. She's just saying, you know, all the general hookers in the area that use that entrance.
Generally, if you're a hooker, you should enter here.
Or if you're a general hooker, if you're not a specific hooker,
right? Okay,
like you'll make it with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, general hookers through here. Specific hookers have another entrance off to the side,
right? Like you have a particular fetish that you specialize in. If you are, if you have a dominatrix situation,
right,
maybe you go through a different way. But if you're just a general, you're just generally speaking a hooker, you walk through that door. Okay,
yeah, you'll service anybody. That's your doorway. That's your entrance. And you can stand there and see that statue coincidentally named General Hooker. What are the odds?
So he was also a prostitute?
No, he was.
No, okay.
No, he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
No, uh-uh.
So this is an actual issue? They actually
this
really...
This is an actual issue. She is trying to get the sign. Listen to her again. It's hurtful.
Female staffers don't use that entrance because the sign is offensive to them. It's just a little semantics, a little wordplay that some people find very charming and funny, I find can be hurtful.
Okay, it's not hurtful unless somebody takes that sign and hits you over the head. Okay, then it is hurtful.
That's how signs hurt you.
It may make you uncomfortable because you're doing the wordplay.
Right, because the sign is not wordplay.
No.
It is not something that people find to be kind of funny.
General
it's the
Hooker
guy's name.
entrance. Mm-hmm. You're going to see General Hooker. That's the entrance. You are playing a little word player going, what are you, eight? General Hooker.
General Hooker's coming through here. Oh, you are a hooker.
I mean, so it is. It's really seventh grade.
We really do have the world we deserve, if that is who we are.
Seriously, women, is this your movement? Are you so...
I will say it's better than the We Hate the Jews Women's March movement. Well, the I'm offended by the hooker sign right. movement is okay. better than the We Hate the Jews Women's March movement.
Okay, again. The bar is very low here. But can we raise it up just a little bit? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is... You know what this is? This is making women... Why? Oh, my... I might be getting a case of the vapors. Oh, my goodness. Don't say that in front of us ladies. I mean, that's what this is. My General Hooker. Well, my stars, I've never... Ooh, I'm just going to... Oh, I've got to sit down. How? What? We need fainting couches for all of these, quote, feminists. Just in case they... Well, I just... Oh, I think I'm a little lightheaded.
It is amazing the sort of weird double standards we have with this stuff. Because, again, like we all, it's the same people who get offended by the word hooker on a sign that is a guy's name are the same people who will tell you that wearing a hat with a female body part on it is completely fine.
Right.
And shan't ever be criticized.
Right. They're the ones who, when you say, hey, can you not use that language? Hey, free speech. Okay. All right. Okay. I just have my nursing daughter and all of my kids who are under eight. And you're using the F word in ways I've not even heard. Right.
Free speech. You don't like it? Go to another country, pal.
Oh, okay. Thank you, ma'am.
It's like we have... Clay Travis goes on CNN and says the word boobs. And it's like a month long... You know, controversy. Right. You know, now I bring that up because I heard a commercial on CNN, the same network, which you're apparently not to say, you're not allowed to say boobs. And they are doing a multi-part special about sex around the world. And again, they're...
Oh, I can't take that.
But okay,
no,
so...
No, I can't take that. I couldn't take the Kennedys special hosted by Martin Sheen. I'm sure that's going to be fair. And the 18-year documentary, The Catholics,
right.
Narrated by Liam Neeson.
It's going to be very fair.
Oh, very fair, and very pro-Catholic, I'm sure.
It's interesting you bring up the host, because that's the part that really weirds me out on this one, because, okay.
Yeah, I know.
I get, you want to do a special on sex, I guess you could do it if you're CNN. I don't know why. You would need to do that, especially if your standard is you're not allowed to say the word boobs on TV.
Ratings.
Right, exactly. But if they wanted ratings, the sex special would not be hosted by Christiane Amanpour, who is literally the worst person on earth to host a sex special. I don't know. I can't quantify why that is, but it is.
No, I think in some circles she is a contraceptive. I mean, she is.
That's possible.
I'm not it. Turn on CNN. Christiane Amanpour is on. That's better than a shower. You're just saying her name. Okay, right. I'm good.
It's a little disturbing. And the double standard is a little frustrating.
Yeah, I just can't take the double standard. That's really the problem. The people who say that we have to not only be tolerant, but we have to celebrate everything everyone believes, unless it's actually history, unless it's an actual name of someone. Why, then, I better sit down. The vapors here are just, look at all the ladies that are just passing out. Those are women of ill repute. Chaos at the grocery stores. Love this. This one, you know,
when the Jews control the weather, like what's his name from the D.C. City Council said, it's the Rothschilds controlling the weather. No, it's not. Mm-mm, no, it's a winter storm. Yeah. Anyway, of course, then again, I think God is Jewish, or he was. I don't know if he's gotten baptized. This is confusing. Anyway, so the storms that are the first thing you see is everybody going to the grocery store and they're panicking. Why? Because they know they have duck sauce and soy sauce in their refrigerator. And so if I've got a panic, I don't know if I can make it 3 days without food. Right now, my Patriot Supply can help you out if you have nothing in the line of food storage. Your 72-hour emergency food kit that is breakfast, lunch, and dinner for one person for 3 days is now $17.76. $17.76. Oh, my. What are the odds? That's also an important year where something happened. I think Columbus or something came to town. Anyway, $17.76 for your 72-hour emergency food kit. Get one for every member of your family. For the most part, I mean, unless things really go crazy, you're done. 72 hours is what the Department of Homeland Security says every American should have. So get one for your family. Now it's $17.76, $17.76. Preparewithglenn.com. That's preparewithglenn.com or call 800-271-63. 800-271-63. Preparewithglenn.com.
Glenn Beck. Mercury. Glenn Beck.
So I want to play something from Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley is a constitutional scholar, liberal or left-leaning law professor at George Washington University. He has been a steady voice since, I think, even in the 90s is when I first started seeing Jonathan Turley. And generally, he is spot on things, and it doesn't matter which side it is, generally speaking. Here's what he had to say over the weekend about the dismissal of McCabe by the FBI. Listen.
Was it justified, this firing?
Well, it was justified in the sense that these were career officials at the Office of Professional Responsibility that made this recommendation, which is exceedingly rare. In fact, it's unprecedented for someone in this position. These are not political appointees. The OPR, quite frankly, is not viewed as a particularly aggressive office. So all of that makes this a relatively rare sanction coming from career officers. They clearly concluded that McCabe misled them, that he misled them on one of the core issues they were investigating, not a collateral issue. What is going to create an issue going forward is whether there will be a criminal referral. You know, Michael Flynn was indicted for making a false statement to investigators. Now, it's true that they were looking at him for other crimes as well. But there will be some that will argue, why would you indict Michael Flynn, but an FBI, a deputy FBI director is just worried about his pension, not prison?
Shouldn't we all be questioning that? I mean, see, this is the problem. Justice is blind. That's the way it's supposed to be. Justice is blind. But I don't think justice is blind. I mean, and we've known that. We've known that because justice wasn't blind for African Americans. Justice wasn't blind for O.J. Simpson in the opposite way. Justice isn't blind for the political people in our country. That's a problem. If you went over after Flynn for lying, you have to go after this guy. Even if you don't go after this guy, if I lie to the FBI, are you going to, under oath, you think they're going to go after me? Of course they will. You do it. Will they go after you? Of course they will. And they should. This is kind of the discussion we had with President Clinton. Can you lie under oath? Does it matter? The answer is no. No.
Seems reasonable. You started the hour with part of his actual statement, McCabe's statement, which was this kind of fiery response saying basically the president is coming after me. He's attacking me. But in the statement, if you read the whole thing, he basically admits he did it. I think. Listen to these two parts. During these inquiries, I answered questions truthfully and as accurately as I could amidst the chaos that surrounded me. And when I thought my answers were misunderstood, I contacted investigators to correct them. Later on, he goes on to say, let's see.
When I thought my answers were misunderstood.
Right. Like, okay, so.
Hell, that's no.
No, that's not what he. But he, again, he's admitting the basis of this. Right. Like that something he said wasn't true.
Correct.
I thought they were misunderstood. Later on, he says, you know, I've always had distinction and integrity. Just ask people around me. To have my career end this way and to be accused of lacking candor when at worst I was distracted in the midst of chaotic events is incredibly disappointing and unfair.
So, I'd like to see what those distractions were or what those distractions caused him to say.
Exactly. So we're going to find that out. We don't have the report yet, right? Mm-hmm. We only have the reporting on the report, which is never the best way to do these mm-hmm. things. But beyond that, it's if this is true, right? Like, let's say there are chaotic events and you make a misstatement. You still get in trouble for that. When you're not telling the truth, particularly if they, again, like you only get in trouble if you did something intentionally wrong. Mm-hmm. The other part of this is it's a good argument as to why you shouldn't, if you're Donald Trump, go in front of Mueller and actually meet with him. Because you, even if there is something that you just misstate or you get the facts wrong,
they will hold him to it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I because I'm an American citizen and want the truth, would be fine with him going to Mueller. If I'm in the president's administration, I'm telling him don't. Because
well, I'm fine with him going in front of Mueller if he can control himself and there's nothing, you know, that he did wrong. I mean, if he did something wrong, I also want him in front of Mueller. But the problem with Trump is he just kind of elaborates and not necessarily all of that is true, and they will hold him to every single word. They won't hold this guy. Even though this was independent, the OPR, this is unprecedented for them to recommend a termination.
Glenn
unprecedented.
Beck, Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Okay, hear me out on this just for a second. What do you think? Constitutional amendment that has an inclusion rider. So, you know, if we're going to get together, we're going to do anything, we just got to check the rider, formerly known as the Constitution. And who do we need to include? There is a really ugly hypocritical side to the prolonged cultural moment that America is having regarding issues of gender and race. And that is a growing hostility to a specific group of people, even as it includes every other group, you know, and preaches to them that you have to include every other group. It's becoming so absurd that even a nerdy conference for history professors at Stanford is being, you know, billed as too white and too male. Last week, a female history professor at Harvard University tweeted some screenshots of several of the speakers at this history conference and wrote, quote, "All male history conference. This goes for the Guinness Book of the Century." I bet not. I bet there's probably more white people that have attended another conference. I'm not sure. A team of 30 white male historians will discuss applied history at Stanford. What a shame. Now, I don't think she means that it's a shame that they're getting together to discuss history or how to apply it. I think she thinks it's a shame because this group of 30 are all white men. She repeated this sentiment over several days, calling the gathering shameful as if it was a Klan history conference. Other female professor critics agreed until finally the browbeating affected the conference director, Niall Ferguson, who is a great historian. He apologized, saying, We did discuss diversity ahead of time and have invited several women, but they were all unable to attend. But even that being said, we, quote, must redouble our efforts to represent diverse viewpoints in future conferences, end quote.
Yeah, you want a diverse look at history? Invite me. Yeah, because see, even though I am a white man, I bet I disagree with a lot of the other white men that are in that conference. Like, we don't have diverse viewpoints? Is it all about the color of our skin and what we have in our pants? Because I think I remember something like Martin Luther King saying something different that we were all supposed to remember and celebrate. And I do. Does anybody else anymore? The current cultural climate. Ferguson had to say something for self-preservation purposes. Are we really all this bored and this self-absorbed that we now have to find white privilege villainy in every nook and cranny of culture? Why are the dark sides of Oreos on the outside? And there's a white filling that, what, holds it together? Well, you're telling me that two dark cookies couldn't hold themselves together? Well, no, in this case, we're talking a cookie. No! Progressives have done a masterful job of turning diversity into their highest virtue. And now that they've achieved that, they're just showing you that, you know, you will be diverse, or we'll eliminate those voices that aren't diverse enough. Oh, okay. All right. Americans all believe different things. And we've been told we should celebrate all those different things that we believe. Now we're being told only celebrate those things that the group leaders tell you we can celebrate. The most important thing, and I remember, boy, I remember hearing people saying this when I was a kid. Instead of focusing on all of the things that divide us, why not focus on a few of the things that unite us? I think that there is still a large section, maybe 80% of this country, left and right, that really are kind of spooked by this diversity policing. They're really kind of spooked by, we want diverse voices, except for those, get them off campus. And if they won't leave, well, throw a Molotov cocktail through a J. Crew window. I think we're all kind of freaked out by that. Diversity policing by citizen cops on social media is a danger to a free society. Of all the people you would think that would get this, you would think that it would be a group of really smart history professors.
No, it's not. It's not. Wow.
It's Monday, March 19th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Wanted to get one of my favorite self-made historians, Brad Meltzer, on the phone, talk about this and his new book, The Escape Artist, which, Brad, I have to tell you, I finished reading. You know, after your interview, I hate having people on and not reading their book. But I it took me, I think, 2 days to read it, and I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning. Thank you. And it was fantastic. The reason why I was up till three is I could not stop reading it. It's a great book.
I appreciate it. I mean, you know, you and I were emailing afterwards, and, you know, I said to you that the most intimate thing in life is being understood and understanding someone else. And you have always just completely gotten what I'm doing. And especially with this book, the emotion that went behind and the history that went behind this, it really did change me. You read it immediately. You wrote to me and said, this book, I feel like it's changed you. And you can't go to Dover Air Force Base and see, you know, some of the most amazing heroes in our society and leave unchanged.
So the message that I wrote to you where I said, this, I think, is almost a reinvention or a re-pointing on the compass of not only your course, but also the action-adventure kind of books. You know, the Jason Bourne kind of book has been done over and over and over again. This is deeper and different. Do you understand that? And how would you explain that?
Yeah, no, I do. I very much understand it because I've been writing for, you know, this is my 20th year writing thrillers. And you and I met, you know, right at the beginning of that career. And usually you write a thriller and, you know, the good guy has to beat the bad guy. And that's basically what the fight is about. And in this book, if I'm really being honest, this book was a transaction like any other. You know, I've done the secret tunnels below the White House. I've done the hidden labyrinth below the Capitol. I thought when I got after my USO tour in the Middle East, I thought that when I went to Dover Air Force Base, it was just going to be like that. I'd walk in, they would tell me some cool stuff. I would write a thriller where the good guys beat the bad guys. And when I got there, I was humble, Glenn. I was humbled by what I saw, by watching these people who take care of our fallen soldiers at Dover Air Force Base. And we all know, you know, Dover's that place where we're used to those flag-covered coffins coming off the planes. What I didn't realize was that Dover has the biggest cases. It's where, whether it's on 9/11, the Pentagon flight victims went, the space mm-hmm. shuttle victims when the space shuttle goes down. But again, what you and I just quickly talked about was those people that take care of those who no one knows about, the spies, our 007s across the country. We've seen in the CIA headquarters, there's stars right behind on the wall. And they say these stars represent fallen soldiers, fallen CIA members who no one can know their name. And the people at Dover know their name because they're rebuilding them when their bodies come back. And to watch them rebuild someone's hand because a mother says, I want to hold my son's hand one last time. Or to rebuild someone's jaw for 14 hours because they say, you know what, I want this family to be able to recognize and see their son or daughter off one last time. And that's humbling.
You write in the book that's not part of their job. That's things that they decide to do, that each of the examiners or the forensics guys, they take their time to do it.
Yeah, the one that I just said to you, 14 hours rewiring someone's jaw, I didn't make that up. That really happened. And the person who did it didn't take overtime for it. They can, 14 hours, but they didn't take overtime because they saw it as a mission. And when I saw that, I knew I wasn't writing a thriller about good guys and bad guys anymore, but I was writing about some of the most important ways we deal with life and look out for each other. And the battles that my character Zig is facing with the loss of a child, with the loss of, you know, trying to reclaim what that hole in his chest will never be able to be filled with, was just bigger than anything I've written about. And I'll tell you this, I couldn't tell you this before because I didn't know it. I was on book tour last week and I stopped in Miami, in my hometown now. And a woman said to me, you know, Brad, I've read all your books. And she said, and they're usually about some kind of, you know, hard luck kid who basically is trying to get to that next level, the Supreme Court, the White House, whatever the next level is. And then they just eventually kind of can't get there. Or when they do get there, they realize it's just not as amazing as they thought it was going to be. And she said, is that right? And my mother-in-law was in the front row. And my mother-in-law laughed and said, huh. But she knew that's my life. And I said to the woman, I said, that's my life. You know, I came from, you know, very modest beginnings. I was the first in my family to go to college. That was my life. I said, you're absolutely right, ma'am. I said, but this book is not that. And what I realized in the last week, without even thinking about it, is what I was writing from is a new perspective. It was the perspective of being a father. Mm. I never did that before. Mm. And now I had Zig being this father who's, you know, again, trying to put to rest all these fallen sons and daughters. And the result was I wrote from my mature place, from what happened over 20 years. I've grown somehow, some way. And I wish I was smart enough to know I was doing that. But I think what you're feeling is that same love you have for your kids, that same love I have for my kids, that's more powerful than any kind of, yeah, you know, trying to achieve something that we'll ever do.
Talking to Brad Meltzer, he is a fantastic writer and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Escape Artist, which is out now. And it's fantastic. One of the better books that I've read in a long time. Brad, I want to change the subject just a little bit and talk to you about, have you seen what's happening with Facebook and the algorithms and how they are taking information and using it? I'm trying to find one story here.
I've seen it, of course. This is incredible. I was obsessed with this story all weekend. I said, I want to do I want to go, you know, if you look at my Twitter feed right the day after the election, it was like a day or two after the election, I said the greatest story that is not being told right now, and it's so obvious now, but I said it then, was how the Russians played with our election and played with us. And again, whatever you want to see. And people were like, oh, you're taking, I'm like, I'm not taking sides. It's just mathematical facts. And over the weekend, a story came out that very high level, not only Russian, but also Republican. And again, Democrats were, you know, they gave it to Democrats too. Democrats just hadn't bited it. I mean, they didn't see the opportunity, but were able to take our Facebook data. And by answering, you know, those little quizzes that they say, are you a happy person? Are you a pessimistic person? Describe yourself. They put these kind of quizzes out on Facebook. And in figuring out these quizzes and what people clicked on, they could figure out our personalities and therefore figure out what we're susceptible to, what kind of ads we're susceptible to, what kind of things could convince us. And it becomes this, you know, and you know that I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think we confuse the word conspiracy with kooky and crazy. This is something that really happened in America. When you have big data out there and information on Facebook out there, and we're constantly liking things and clicking things, eventually it gives you a profile of who we are. And if you can take all those millions of profiles of people, you can figure out how to influence them. And the thing that I think upsets all of us is we don't like, you know, it's like subliminal advertising. We don't like being influenced without us knowing we're being influenced. And that's what they did here.
So I want to come back, take a quick break, and I want to talk to you about a new algorithm that I am really concerned about. It came out in Bloomberg this weekend, and it is something that I have read about in, you know, all the futurist books. But apparently it's here now. And, you know, I just think it's wildly dangerous. And I would love to pick your mind, because I think the truth is stranger than fiction. And so there's nobody better to go to than a fiction writer and say, how does this one go wrong? Brad Meltzer in a second. If you've ever taken your car in for an oil change and the mechanic finds something wrong and you're like, what? And you find yourself with a repair bill that you didn't expect, it's happened to all of us. You know, there is nothing worse than seeing that check engine light go on. When you see that check engine light, you're, is it just me? You're just like, oh, crap. I mean, back in the day, we used to be able to disconnect the check engine light. And so then we didn't worry about it. When you have an extended vehicle protection warranty, if you will, from CarShield like I do, you don't have to worry about that. The little check engine light goes on, you can bring it in and you don't have any worries. If your car breaks down after the warranty expires, you're going to be out of pocket thousands of dollars possibly to get that fixed. Replacing your engine alone is thousands. A simple repair cost for a sensor can cost $1,000. My son-in-law just had this, and he didn't have CarShield. Boy, did he feel stupid. He didn't have CarShield, and it cost him $5,000. That's more than the car was worth. CarShield makes the process of fixing your car for a covered repair super easy. You can have your favorite mechanic or your dealership do the work. It's your choice. They get them paid. You don't have to wait for the check. They also provide you 24/7 roadside assistance and a rental car while yours is being fixed for free. So if your car has 5,000 to 150,000 miles, it doesn't mean you have to pay a high repair bill. CarShield administrators have paid out close to $2 billion in claims, and they're ready to help you. Go now to CarShield. Call them at 800-CAR-6100, 800-CAR-6100. Mention the promo code or visit carshield.com and use the promo code Beck and you'll save 10%. The promo code is Beck. That's carshield.com. Deductible may apply.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
So here's a story got out of Bloomberg, talking to Brad Meltzer, the author of The Escape Artist. If humans are going to entrust big decisions on computers, how can they ensure that these computers act in humanity's best interest? Amazingly, given the increasing power and persuasiveness of algorithms, it's a question that researchers are just beginning to answer. How can we make sure that they act fairly? To start with, we need to define fair. At a recent conference, New York University, they were asked, should a risk profiler, for example, treat all racial groups equally regardless of their other differences? Should it acknowledge differences but focus on achieving similar error rates? Should it correct for previous wrongs? Do some definitions seem good in the short term but have negative long-term repercussions? What are we headed for, Brad?
I think, you know, what we're headed for, I read this amazing article, and these are the things, you know, why I love talking about them is, you know, these are the things that years ago I got invited by the Department of Homeland Security to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And the reason that I think they brought people like myself in who are fiction writers is they wanted to figure out what's the craziest thing you could do. And what I was fascinated with is I started studying why, you know, when did they start bringing people in like this? How did this happen? And one of the things that they told me and that I found out is there was a conference a few years back of futurists, people who kind of try to fathom what the future is going to bring or really good at figuring out what the future will bring. And the number one thing that they said, what's the greatest threat to the United States right now? And it used to be things like nuclear war, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. The greatest threat, according to these futurists now, is a small group of individuals who have just an idea that they can't shake and they're willing to do anything for it. And it's what society is facing right now is the ability of people to a small group, not a country. We're not fighting Russia. We're not fighting the Cold War anymore. We're fighting a tiny group of people. This is, if you saw this article you're talking about, it, you know, it's a group of like a small business is what we're fighting. Who are basically able to influence us. And the article that I read that really scared me is what we lose in all of this, the real thing that dies is truth. That's what disappears because we don't realize anymore. We can't trust what we see.
So how do you, how do you solve for that? What do you do to prepare?
I have been thinking of it all weekend. I've been literally thinking, you know, can Facebook take away news? Can you take away politics from it? Can you limit it to just people posting about their kids and dogs in the way that, you know, we know is fair? Mm-hmm. And the truth is I don't know how. I personally think that this is one of those things, the same way we regulate what the news is on TV, the same way we try to regulate at least certain things, is Facebook can't be the Wild West. It has too much power. And when you have that much power to influence billions of people and the way that they think, you have a problem. Mm-hmm. You have a real problem. And I think that, you know, when you look at Mark Zuckerberg saying, you know what, this never happened, and then quickly realizing, oh my gosh, this did happen and we need to take, you know, we have to figure out what the consequences are. I don't know if anyone knows what to do, but I would say this to everyone listening is when you see something on Facebook that's posted, it's so easy to click a like and say, man, I agree with that.
But check it first. Escape Artist is the name of the book, Brad Meltzer.
Glenn,
thanks, Brad.
Back. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I want to play the audio here from D.C. Council Member Trayon White Sr. He is... He's on the city council, and it was snowing. He was driving in his car, and he decided to post a video, driving and doing a video. But that's not what's...
They all unite to ban texting, but yeah, God forbid. Right. Of course, you can obviously video and make live commentary as a council.
Sure. Here's what he said. Listen.
Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man. Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, man. This climate manipulation. And D.C. keep talking about we're a resilient city. And that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate to create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful.
Mm-hmm. You should be careful of that. I mean, I would say if that's occurring in your area.
Which? The Jews?
The Jews controlling the weather? It's something to be careful about.
Yeah.
That's just a public service announcement from this program.
Right. Okay. I don't think that's true that Jews are trying to control the weather to take over our cities, but
he didn't say it was true. He just said you should need to watch out for it.
Okay,
You know,
so he's apologized. He's apologized this morning, and I want you to listen carefully to this apology.
In response to my social media post on Friday, as a leader, I work hard every day to combat racism and prejudices of all kinds.
Don't think he wrote this.
No. It gets to a point with me, you might believe it. I want to apologize to the Jewish community and anyone that I have offended. The Jewish community have been allies with me in my journey to help people. I did not intend to be anti-Semitic, and I see I should not have said that after learning from my colleagues.
He wrote that line. He wrote that line.
So he didn't intend to be anti-Semitic, and he sees now that he should not have said that after learning from his colleagues.
All right, so wait.
So
he's sorry he didn't mean to go after the Jews, but he now realizes that he shouldn't have said that because somebody told him that's a bad idea to say that?
It does appear to be the order of events.
But do you think that means, hey, that was stupid to say, or that's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard?
I mean, maybe you could argue he didn't realize the Rothschilds controlling the weather was an anti-Semitic conspiracy. Like, maybe he just is just a crazy conspiracy theorist and is just believing it, but not for the anti-Semitic reasons.
He can drive.
He can drive.
And he has access to the internet.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say this was a well-researched post. I mean, he seemingly was doing it off the top of his head as he was operating a motor vehicle.
Listen to it again for the science purposes here, for the scientific reasons. Listen to it again.
Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man.
Snowing out of nowhere.
Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, man. This climate manipulation. And D.C. keep talking about we're a resilient city. And that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate to create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful.
I'm wondering where he heard that.
I don't know. Maybe on the internet.
Maybe on the internet? Is it possible that he is somebody who follows Louis Farrakhan?
I don't know. It's good. That would be interesting. A good follow-up question.
A good follow-up question. Where did you learn about the Rothschilds and their weather machine?
Mm. The interesting, you know, he says that it starts snowing out of nowhere, as if the snow goes from the state of there's no snow and then the snow begins, which is also would describe every other snowstorm that's ever occurred. It's always not snowing and then snowing. That's how
just comes out of nowhere. It's actually coming out of the clouds above.
That's how that works. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a strange observation.
And really, you have a long time to prepare. Like, people in California don't have so long because the rest of the, you're not seeing tape of the rest of the country getting that storm.
No.
You get it at the very end. It's traveled all the way across the country.
I will say, too, this is only a visual, but for those of you who did not see the video of this, there's like four flakes falling from the sky. It is not snowing a lot. This is the worst climate control effort of all time. The Jews are losing their game. They apparently are not good at this anymore.
They're not good at that.
He goes on, by the way, to say, I have spoken to leaders and my friends at Jews United for Justice, or JUVJ, and they are helping me to understand the history of comments made against Jews, and I am committed to figuring out ways to continue to be allies with them and others.
Mm.
So there you go. That's
well,
a big statement.
I think he's learned his lesson. Let me ask you this. Aaron Hernandez, they're now saying he was gay and that he killed this guy in 2013 because he knew that Hernandez was gay.
I've heard this rumor before. Aaron Hernandez, of course, New England Patriots tight end, was convicted of murder, also acquitted of another double murder, I believe it was. I'm getting all of his murders confused, but he did wind up killing himself fairly recently. But they're now saying that it's a gay issue. He was closeted and did not, and was afraid he would.
He was angry about it. He was angry about it.
Hmm.
Okay.
Is there any evidence to support this theory?
Well, his defense team says, It was clear that this man was gay.
Now, is it okay? I'm
so
is it,
when you have evidence like that,
it was clear.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, would it make a difference? in his sentencing? Is they, do gay
well, that's
people
what I wanted to ask.
To be
I thought we would. It would be nice. I couldn't get Kevin Spacey on the phone, but the last time I heard a defense like this was from Kevin Spacey.
You can't get me for Me Too because I'm gay.
Yeah.
That was essentially his answer. Yeah.
Hey, I only did this because I'm gay.
That was the squirrel of essentially his statement.
Yeah.
Look at this instead of the first thing. And by the way, the media went along with that initially. Many of the initial stories was Kevin Spacey comes out as gay, which is exactly what he was trying to do. Instead of it being about him potentially assaulting all of these people, allegedly, and him losing his giant job and really all of his jobs, not only House of Cards, but also the... Richest Man in the World, or what was that movie that Christopher Plummer wound up taking his role from? And obviously, he's just basically out of work now.
You think this would work for Andrew McCabe? If he just came out today
and went, smart.
I'm gay.
He fired me because I'm gay.
Yeah, I'm gay.
That's a very smart approach. I don't know. It doesn't seem to work. I feel like that worked better at one point. Poor Kevin.
Yeah, do you think?
He
I don't think it should have.
No.
But maybe it did. It didn't work for Kevin Spacey. I don't know. Murder somebody. I'm gay. Yeah, but you murdered somebody.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a trait of gayness.
Here's an interesting set of standards we can all discuss today.
Right.
Which is maybe if you're black and if you're gay and if you're Jewish and if you're white, you should be treated the same. Maybe if you commit a crime, you should go to prison for the same amount of time.
No.
Maybe if you're a politically connected Democrat, you should still get fired if you break the rules.
No.
Maybe the media shouldn't just immediately side with you because you're from a protected group of some sort.
No.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Again, I go back to that Bloomberg article. By the way, Jim Caviezel is going to be with us in studio here in about 20 minutes. The algorithm that they are now designing, we're only beginning to understand, for example, how facial recognition technology tends to misidentify minorities. Real problem if police are using it to search for suspects. The standard procedure is set algorithms loose on people without checking for flaws and almost with little or no mechanism for appeal. So how do we get these machines to act fairly? Well, we have to define fair. Should a risk profiler, for example, treat all racial groups equally, regardless of their other differences? Well, I would say yes. Now, if it's going to misidentify people because it's misreading features, then that's a problem. But when it comes to, hey, who's the best shot at killing this person? I think as long as we're putting facts in, I don't really care what color they are. White, black, yellow, it doesn't matter to me. Should it acknowledge differences but focus on achieving similar error rates? Should it correct for previous wrongs?
That
would be good.
That's going to be a fun one.
Yeah.
Correcting for previous wrongs. That's a wonderful pathway.
Do some definitions seem good in the short term, but have negative longer repercussions? The right balance seems to be somewhere in the middle. The latest paper finds that if members of a disadvantaged group are given loans at rates higher than in the maximum profit scenario, but lower than the forced equality scenario, they broadly improve their credit scores. This comes at short-term cost to the lender, but is likely beneficial in the longer term as society as a whole becomes better off.
Yeah, one of the things they found was that some groups gave a lot of loans to underprivileged minority groups or whatever to try to be fair. And that fairness led them to getting loans they should not have had, which also led them to defaulting on loans that they should not have had, which wound up hurting them in the long term because they went bankrupt or ruined their credit because they had loans they shouldn't have had.
Yes, but that happening to a few people, that's okay. We can have the algorithm spit out. The algorithm will mean nothing. Mean nothing. If an algorithm spits out something that is politically correct, instead of this is what's most likely to happen, then it's of no use. It's of no use. It's just a social justice tool. Oh my, I never thought of it that way. Criminal risk scores can turn people into criminals. and Facebook's news feed, sure, they keep people engaged, but they also promote outrage and even catalyze violence. What? No, look, here's the thing. Okay, I think we all really, I mean, I hate to, you know, ask everybody to put that on their big pants here for a second, but Facebook isn't doing any of this. We are. We are. Okay, Facebook is playing off us, but you're smart enough to figure this out, that there's an algorithm that gives you what you want and what you like. See the button that says like? That means, if you're a capitalist, I'm going to give you more of what you like, less of what you don't like. That's capitalism. That's the way this is working. Now, if we were all like, you know, well, I was going to say normal human beings, but I don't think normal human beings are what I thought normal human beings were. If we were at all responsible, we would do our own homework and not just look at the headline and read the first paragraph and then repost it because it reconfirmed our worldview.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of conservatives I've heard with, you know, that are critical of Facebook and other social media accounts or suppliers. Platforms for this, saying like, you know, hey, they need to fix their thing so that X, Y, and Z doesn't happen. But it's really the same argument that the left brings up on Hardee's, right? Like Hardee's is providing a 2/3 of a pound thick burger that's 1,200 calories. You don't have to buy it.
It's exactly the same thing as talk radio. We've got to balance talk radio. We have to fix talk radio. We have to make sure that we treat people like morons. No, no. Just let the monkey tails fall off all of the morons. That's what we need to do. Simply Safe Home Security is prepared for anything that gets thrown at it. A storm takes out your power, they're ready. An intruder cuts your phone line, they're ready. Somebody comes in and destroys your keypad or your siren, they still call for help. Maybe it's overkill, but Simply Safe doesn't think so. I mean, in the worst case scenario, you'd be hoping that they planned for the worst case scenario, and they have. This is what makes Simply Safe Home Security so great. It's always ready, and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. Instead, they only charge you what's fair. 24/7 professional security monitoring is only $14.99 a month. There are no contracts. There are no hidden fees. Simply Safe. Simply Safe. Check it out now. See how much money you're going to save with SimplySafeBeck.com. Keep yourself and your family protected and safe with SimplySafeBeck.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
A friend of mine, Jim Caviezel, is in with us in just a few seconds. He's in the green room now, getting ready to come on in. He'll be joining us at the top of the hour. Jim Caviezel, of course, played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ. And I don't think he has... Have you seen him deliver a piece of acting that was just, meh? I mean, he's
always good in everything.
He is always great in everything. He's just, I think, one of the best actors of our day. But because he played Jesus, he's paid a heavy price for it. So he's decided to branch out a little bit this time. He's now playing Luke, the Apostle of Christ. This movie is coming out, Paul, the Apostle of Christ, and Jim Caviezel plays Luke, risking his life to visit Paul, who's held captive in the Roman prison. And he'll be talking about that and also his life. And he's a fascinating guy, really fascinating guy. We went to school together. He's just such a good, decent man. He's everything. You know, he's one of those people that you meet and you're like, I wonder what he's like. Exactly the way you think he is. Just really quiet and gentle and peaceful and kind, and he's a really nice guy. So we'll catch up with him here in just a few minutes.
You know, Passion of the Christ only made $611 million worldwide in 2004.
But that's it.
That's
it. 2004?
Yes, 2004. Now, that should not be confused with the movie Passion, released in 2013, starring Rachel McAdams, directed by Brian De Palma, that made $92,181.
Ah, okay.
A little bit, right. I guess, of the Christ was important.
I guess, it was.
It was an important part
of that.
May
not have been a church film.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah. But this was, I mean, you know, this is Mel Gibson. This is the first really big film since, you know, probably Cecil B. DeMille in that genre that was really done right. And look how far this the faith films have come now. I mean, the third highest grossing film this weekend is a faith film. I can only imagine. And it's really, really good. So Jim Caviezel joins us here in just a few minutes.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Love, courage, truth. Glenn Beck.
Well, it won't surprise you to hear that Vladimir Putin has been re-elect president. You know, he only barred the opponent who posed a threat from running in the election. It also shouldn't surprise you that Putin won by a nearly impossible margin. I think he won by 77%. Ballot stuffing and forced voting on election day stand as, you know, almost like a cartoon of the old KGB in Russia. Under mysterious circumstances, Russian critics of Putin have been poisoned and kidnapped and murdered or tortured. Hey, this one's missing. We just saw last week in the UK when Russian ex-spy and his daughter were poisoned by a Soviet-era nerve agent. Putin's re-election represents the latest in a history of corruption that can only metastasize and darken in Russia. Putin doesn't wince as he violates freedoms and democracy. He takes, and he forces. The rules don't apply to Vladimir Putin. I don't think I need to tell you that he's dangerous. Some people don't think he is. This is a man without honor, whose word is worthless as his reign. But unfortunately, his reign is endless. And a man like this cannot be trusted. His bloodthirst continues. He's going to be around now until 2024. And then he'll, quote, be forced to step down. Although there's plenty of time to change the term limit rules. I don't know if you caught this, but that's exactly what they did in China.
It's Monday, March 19th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Jim Caviezel is in studio with us, a good man and a friend. We grew up kind of together. I mean, we went to the same elementary school, and you were, what, 2 years behind me, Jim?
No, I was in third grade when you were in eighth grade.
Oh, okay.
But I saw you first, second, and third grade.
And you remember it.
I remember you in the wide-legged corduroy pants.
Yep, that was me.
Robert Conine, Rosencrantz.
Oh yeah.
Peter Janicki.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
And so we rode the bus, school bus together. I remember you jumping up and down up on Peter Janicki's shoulders. I remember Sister Agnes Joseph coming to our class and said she just saw you debate the entire class. Michael Rosencrantz told me that boy is a genius, and she was saying
well,
that
none of those stories are
and
true.
Janicki was pretty yeah. genius too.
Yeah, none of those stories but are I true. Just, but so how are you?
I'm good.
Yeah. Now you're in a new film called Paul, Apostle of Christ. I haven't seen it yet. Yes. It comes out. When does it come out?
March 23rd.
Okay. Last time I saw you, you had, you were still reeling from, you know, the temptation of Christ, but,
Passion
of Christ. And you were still reeling from that. And I think you are one of the bravest men I think I've ever met. One of the most loyal men to God that I have ever met. And I think, wrongfully persecuted for what you've done, the standards that you have taken. You've been very careful and very true
when you were in school, when we were there together, you made a promise to God. Can you talk about that?
I was given a gift, and I think it's very difficult for God to give certain people gifts, because once they get the opportunity, it starts out being, you know, here, God, I'll give you all that, and it becomes, you know, 9 for you, 1 for me, and then eventually becomes 9 for me, 1 for you.
Yeah.
So I just said that I would make the kind of films that would, you know, affect people's lives, like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. When I met Jimmy Stewart, I was a waiter for him, and I went and got him a drink, and I was working at a party, and they told me I couldn't, you know, speak to any of the celebrities, and I saw that guy, and I thought, well, I could, you know, get fired for talking to him. So at the time, I had applied to the U.S. Naval Academy. I applied 3 different times and didn't get in. Mm-hmm. I had a shot at West Point, and I told him, you know, I know that you've flew the Liberators over Germany, and he was just shocked that I knew. Here I am, you know, mm-hmm. 19 years old, 20 years old, and I knew so much about him. And I think that Ed Clooney told me one time, George said that when they were at Rose, he was with Rosemary, his aunt, and they were at Stewart's house, and on the TV was his Academy Award, and Stewart said, you know, I wish I had done more. And here's a guy that made arguably one of the greatest films ever made. I watch it every year. It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have that kind of effect on people, but it was always God through me that would make these films great.
Is it true that you said, I want to play you?
No, I said, I don't want them to see me. I want them only to see you. And that became the difference. And to do that was on the cross. Yes, I felt the love that he had for me. But when I asked him to come closer like that, he said, you may not like what you're going to get. And I said, as long as they see you, that's all that matters. And what I felt was a broken heart, because our Lord's not loved by most of his children. And, you know, I tell people, I know God loves you. And if you don't know that, then, you know, kind of live the life that that makes people feel that. But those that say that have accepted that, you know, just get up in the morning and tell Jesus that you love him. He needs to hear that too.
You would have gotten along with Hollywood a long time ago, with the Jimmy Stewarts of the world.
Ma'am.
I think they were more like you.
Right.
Now, not so much. Not so much. And yet you are consistently amazing in every role I have ever seen you in. You are just tremendous.
Glenn, I've said this before. The Hollywood at best, you know, if that really is the world, at best, it can only like you, because the love, it does not come from man. It comes from God. So at best, Hollywood can like you, and I can prove it to you. When you go to the Academy Awards, former winners are on the sideline. People are making over. It's over the current winner, and you look some of the films and the substance that's coming out of them, and they're making all over that. People will give up everything for a red carpet. But the question you have to ask yourself is, do you want to be liked by many or loved by one?
I have a friend, John Irwin from the Irwin Brothers, and they just made a film. What's the name of it? I Can Only Imagine. Came out this weekend. Supposed to make $2 million. It's a faith film. It's really good. It has Dennis Quaid in it. Supposed to make $2 million. It made $17 million. It's only in 1,600 theaters. It was number 3.
Wow.
This weekend.
Yeah, that means the per screen average was more than the two films prior to, that are ahead of them. Oh, that's over $10,000 a screen.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And you're not reading about it anywhere, but
no, you won't.
Yeah. But since you were in Passion, things have changed. You don't need Hollywood as much as you did.
The system, you know, the truth is out there, and it's not going to go away. And you know, the
Irwin guy, brothers.
Yeah, he came up one of the, I don't know which one, but anyway,
John.
He did the Steve McQueen documentary. Did you see that American Icon?
Yeah, yeah.
He handed it to me when I walked out, and I went home and I watched it. And here, I mean, we can arguably say that Steve McQueen was one of the greats. A physical actor, a guy who was absolutely the king of cool. But what was cool about him? He was hot about something. He was an orphan kid, essentially. And I watched this documentary. It just moved me to tears. And that even at the end, he was searching for something greater. And he said there was a recording of him that his wife gave out. And he said that he'd wished he had touched more people's lives. From Jesus, and Billy Graham was there at the end of his life, and he was looking for his Bible as he was dying, and Billy Graham gave him his Bible. Who he was a great that just passed away, and without Billy Graham, we would not have, you know, had the reaction from America. We needed his support, and he gave it to us on the Passion of the Christ.
What do you think about the division between our faith sometimes, you know, between, you know, the Baptists and the Catholics and the Mormons and the Protestants and everything else. How do we solve that and come together on bigger issues?
Well, it's certainly not going to be beating you over the head. I mean, if God wanted to, he certainly could beat us over the head.
Yeah. Isn't he, though?
What?
Beating us over the head. I think he is starting to beat us over the head.
Well, it eventually can come to that, but right now there is a wrath or a justice that's coming if we don't I really feel that the ideal way would be love, that we would just naturally turn to him, and that I got that at a young age. We have an opportunity right now to decide where we want to go. As far as, you know, our all feeling, I do believe there is one truth, and we'll know that one day in heaven. If there were many truths, there would not be a truth, and there would be much divisions in heaven. What there is probably the right way, but I look at Jesus, and he did not beat people over the head with, you know, either turn or burn. Now that is out there, but it's what I find is that you have the truth. Years ago, it would be given to us just truth, and then essentially that would become fire and brimstone. And now it's like all grace, you know, all love and forgiveness and everything. But then that becomes sentimental hogwash. Our Lord is both truth and grace.
Are you happy?
Yes. When I came in here, I was a little frustrated. But generally, yes, because I know that I'm, you know, I have a future forever with Jesus, you know, in heaven. And I tell people that, you know, I do believe in, I do believe it's worth dying for. And I know I'm going to die someday. And I tell people that because, you know, I tell people, yes, our Lord loves you, but I don't always feel that. It is hard, but it, you know, come hell or high water, you do the right thing, no matter what. You just try to keep doing it.
I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because doing the hard thing or doing the right thing is really hard, and you're a guy who has actually walked that walk. You've really walked that walk.
Hey, you know Marcus Luttrell. That was the last event we were at.
Yeah.
Marcus reached out to me because I put in a movie, The Count of Monte Cristo, God Will Give Me Justice, and he wrote that on the cave wall.
Yeah.
And then we became close, and I was, the last time I was with him, I was with him and Chris Kyle.
Oh.
And I never saw him again, obviously, that night. We went on a great night, and they want to just talk about that. But how many soldiers that come up to me in the airports, and you know, special forces guys just ask me about Jesus? That I said, do you really believe in that? I mean, I heard you suffer. I heard you, you know, were struck by lightning and had open heart surgery, that you went through horrible pains. Do you really believe in that stuff? And why are they asking me that? And then eventually they talk about, you know, I've had to take somebody's life by my own hand.
Yeah.
And what that's like. And is there a place in heaven for me? You know, almost like daring God. It reminds me of Gary Sinise in Forrest Gump when he's up at the top of that tower and says, all right, God, it's you and me.
Yeah.
And I just love to, I identify with them.
Yeah.
That there are people out there that will suffer whatever it takes because they feel a brotherhood, and I feel that brotherhood with our Lord, and I want to let them know that they're loved.
Back with Jim Caviezel here in just a second. He's got a new movie out called Paul, Apostle of Christ. It is in theaters Friday, the 23rd. That's this Friday. You can find out more about it at paulmovie.com. Twitter handle at paulmovie. Jim Caviezel, when we return. Have you ever wanted to refinance your mortgage, but you didn't want to start a 30-year loan again? Well, American Financing can help. With refinancing, you can eliminate the mortgage insurance, lower your rate, consolidate your high-interest debt, and you don't have to worry about, you know, resetting your loan. You don't have to do it for 30 years. They offer 9, 13, or 18-year loans. Really, pretty much any term that you need. It's a custom loan. You choose the term based on your budget, and they're going to find the most competitive interest rate. It's your mortgage, your way. Plus, with a fixed rate, no matter where the interest rates go, yours stays the same. Monthly payments don't increase, just takes one phone call to the salary-based mortgage consultants, and they're going to guide you through everything. Call them now at 800-906-2440. That is 1-800-906-2440 or AmericanFinancing.net.
American Financing Corporation, NMLS 182334, www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Jim Caviezel, you might know him from many, many movies that he has been in. Most famously, obviously, he played Jesus in Passion of the Christ, but also Person of Interest, the People's Choice Award, and now in a new movie called Paul, Apostle of Christ. And you play Luke.
I do.
Tell me about it.
Well, it's the film is right at the end of Paul's life, like the last 2 weeks, and he's in the Mamertine prison in Rome. And this is during one of the biggest terror reigns of Christians, which was during Nero. And I basically get into the prison and try to bring his message of hope to the Christian communities that are barely alive in that area. And of course, they're crucifying and burning them, using them as light fixtures all over Rome. And I'm trying to give his message of hope, and he really doesn't have the message that they're looking for. They don't know what to do. And so really the film, when I read it, I said, wow, this is now. This is just, we're all playing characters in scripture right now. You know, often people, when they look at the Bible, they say, well, it's a piece of history. It's not the same as if, you know, if you were to go back, you know, we were just talking about Berlin, you know, mm-hmm. or Germany. And that's a history. You try to learn from history. But this is something quite extraordinary when you read scripture, because it permeates your brain into your heart and bypasses it and goes into that. It's really, and we're all playing a different character, you know. Mm-hmm. I got to play Jesus in the Passion, but some of us, you know, get to play Judas, and some play are the Pharisees, and some are Herod. And that's playing out right now.
The Pharisees, I mean, the real problem there was the hypocrisy. And there's where a lot of us are Pharisees right now.
Yes. And there are Judases out there too.
You've taken quite a hit your whole career. What gets you through? Your low points, you know, you are a great actor. And because of what you believe, you're not asked to be in all of the great films.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get through that?
I get through it because I was in the greatest film there ever was. You know, look, I almost never became an actor. I almost never did The Passion of the Christ. I almost never married my wife, Carrie. I almost never adopted my three children. All three of them had tumors. One had the cancer, sarcoma. And I thought, well, I'm not the kind of guy that can adopt. You know, I'm too selfish. That would have been the worst mistake of my life if I had almost not done those things. The path of Christ is hard. It is the road less traveled. Yeah. It is one that is beyond anything I've ever experienced. And I know it's the way for me. I know, yeah, sure, I've pouted and played the victim, but I realize that, yeah, it's not really going to get it done. Victim is not a strong position.
Jim Caviezel. The name of the movie is Paul, Apostle of Christ. It is in theaters this Friday. Don't miss it.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program. We're glad you're here. Jim Caviezel is here. Pat Gray has just joined us from the Pat Gray Radio Roundup or whatever it is.
That's exactly what it is.
Whatever it's called. Pat Gray Radio Roundup. It happens after this program. Pat, Jim Caviezel, Jim, Pat.
Jim. We've met actually before.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. But I wanted to make sure that I was being a gracious host here.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. That's nice. Good to see you again, though.
Good to see you too, Pat.
So have you been, Jim, have you been down to Waco? Have you seen, you know, Chip and Joanna Gaines?
No, I don't.
Do you know of them?
No, I don't.
Oh, you got it. Oh, you're kidding me. Oh, they're great. Do you watch TV at all, or you've...
I watch a little bit, you know, here and there. I'm just doing a lot of the...
I know you're making it. I know. I was down in Waco. I went down to the
this weekend
silos. That place is
amazing.
Has totally transformed. I mean, these people are so good, and people are flocking from all over the country.
And they've completely repositioned Waco, Texas, because Waco was what? It was Branch Davidian. It was Wacko Waco. And now they've transformed it into this desirable place to go to see.
And it's
business.
Really, it's amazing because here they are, they're people really pretty much like you that just kind of live their principles and, you know, they're not ashamed of their faith. And they do this little show on, you know, HGTV, and it's turned into this monster. And I don't think people in New York or Los Angeles really even understand it. You know, they think, well, it's a husband and wife. No, it's their principles and their values that really set them apart. And they've just, there was probably 100,000 people down there.
I bet.
I mean, it was crazy.
It's always just jam-packed.
Yeah, and they're not even there. Yeah. It's just, it's crazy what they've done.
Yeah, but everybody there is hoping for a glimpse, you know. Maybe this is the day they'll be running out and, I don't know, straightening the shelves.
yeah, straightening things up. So Jim is here because he's in a new movie, Paul, Apostle of Christ. And, you know, Jim, I was, I love the story of Paul. But the thing that sticks in my mind in Paul's life, well, there's many things, but when he's on the wrong side, you know, at the death of James, he's mentioned just give me your coat, you go kill him.
Oh, Stephen.
Or Stephen. Yeah. Thank you. He's standing there and he's listening to Stephen and he's help riling up the crowd. And he doesn't do any of the beating him to death. He just says, give me your cloak. I'll hold it for you.
Yeah, essentially, probably taking their cloaks and handing them stones and have at him.
Yeah, and just, I mean, it's real evil manipulation. I mean, where he was the guy kind of behind the crowd.
Yeah, but I think that when Stephen called out, you know, I see the Son of Man, repeating the words of Jesus, I see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Father coming in the clouds of heaven. That reflection in his eyes He probably saw our Lord right there and probably was the beginning of the end of Saul.
How difficult would it be for you if you knew that Saul was coming your way and you were told, you know, Jim, I need you to go give him a blessing real quick. How difficult would that be for you? I think that would have been terrifying.
Well, of course, but, you know, I look at the some of the videos and pictures that I saw from what ISIS did to Christians last year during Good Friday, where they literally executed them by crucifixion. And I think the modern day Christians really have to understand that, you know, we're all going to die someday. And, you know, being in heaven, I'd rather be known as someone who did something for Jesus than spending eternity without doing much for him.
Do you spend any time in the Middle East recently?
Yes. I had to shoot a movie out there, The Stoning of Sariah M. And, that really exposed Sharia law, and it's just extraordinary what happens to women there.
Yeah.
And I played a guy named Freyadim Saramjam, who was a guy who was just out there to write a story about the Ayatollah takeover of the Shah, and there was a peaceful movement and whatnot, and out of this comes this woman's story of being stoned to death, and that the stonings still take place. So it was I don't feel we had a lot of help from many of the groups here. You know, many of the women groups that weren't there to help their.
I will tell you that it's been encouraging to us. We've raised probably $30 million now.
Yeah,
to get some of these Christians out. We've taken 7,000 out of the Middle East. We're rescuing
that's great.
Slaves and it's remarkable that while it's not talked about, there is this I don't know, underground, would you call it, Pat? This kind of this something that's not on the surface and nobody's talking about, but there is real concern for that and real the people really helping.
Good. A lot of people are helping, but they're doing it in quiet ways, or working in a, like you say, the underground.
Yeah. The Christians are unlike anything I've ever met.
Chaldeans, Syrians, extraordinary.
They're not like anything I've ever met.
They're committed.
Yeah.
You know, they have to be. And they are.
They, you know what? I read a quote this weekend I'd written down a long time ago, and I've forgotten all about it. They tend church, not attend church.
Mm.
You know, they're tending every day. They are there. They know what it is. It's not just a place they go to every Sunday.
Yeah.
And they take it seriously because it doesn't come easy for them like it does us. You know, when you have to fight for something and put your life on the line for something, I think that changes you inside a little bit. It makes you more committed. And
yeah,
they definitely are.
Yeah. And we get so fat and lazy over here on everything that we don't know.
Yeah.
It has no value. Has no value.
It's a great line in the film where Paul says to live is Christ, to die is gain. You know, I'm sure many of those Chaldean, Syrian Christians and Coptics believe in the same way. You know?
Yeah. Is it true, on another topic, that there's a Passion of the Christ sequel coming?
Yes.
And you are signed on for that?
Yes.
Yeah? Wow.
As Jesus?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, he'd have to be, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, you know, it's the next
now
day.
Now I've turned
it's
into been... John, so no. Surprise!
I mean, you don't really look that different. You work out and all that crap all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's overrated.
Fortunately, well, I have to, because there's so much of the work that you do is involves stunt. So if you don't keep that up, you're gonna
especially on that. I mean, on that one, that one was pretty. You know, that was pretty serious.
Yeah,
struck by lightning.
Yeah, last shot of the movie, very last shot. Mm.
What went through your, I mean, besides juice, what went through your head on that?
I was scared, you know, but it wasn't my time, you know, I had physical problems, you know, with electrical heart and everything like that after that. And I was on a lot of medication. So in 2009, I had my first heart surgery. And then 2014
wow.
was open heart at Cleveland Clinic, and they saved my life.
And it was because of that? It was yes. because of the...
I mean, it was a combination of the lightning bolt and then the hypothermia. And then the pneumonia.
Mm. Have you thought about suing Mel? I mean, just taking it for everything that he's worth.
He's worth a few bucks now. You might want to think about that.
He's a really nice guy. He is, I don't know him at all, but in meeting him, he's really quite brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a freak show.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
going at about a Michael
Jordan.
Miles an hour.
Yeah. He'd be the Michael Jordan of in my business of what he can do. You know, it's extraordinary with him because, you know, I mean, you see him in Hamlet. He can do Hamlet. He can do his range.
Yeah.
His humor.
Yeah.
Just, you know, even looking at Lethal Weapon and when Steve McAvity, who produced The Passion, produced Lethal Weapon with Mel, and you know, at the opening of the movie, he takes a gun and he's going to put it in his mouth and he uses a bullet, and, you know, and he's going to commit suicide, and just how he layers takes the if you have an onion, he just peels it away. Then later on, he's up on top of the building, this guy's going to commit suicide, and he's smoking a cigarette up on the building. He's like, come on, man, it's not good to commit suicide. It's really bad for your health, you know? And you're laughing your head off because you know this guy just tried to take it. But how he just sets it up and he gets you focused over here. He's smoking a cigarette. Here, you want a drag? And then he throws up another ball up in the air. And then while you're looking over here, his sleight of hand, he puts the cuffs on the guy's wrist. And then he's like, oh, you jerk, I'm going to jump. He goes, do you really want to do it? I want to do it. And so you go, no, the movie's over. Yeah. Jumps off. And then, of course, they don't show it. But then they jump on that big old bag. You're this guy's nuts. You hear that? Mel goes, oh, that's fun. Let's do it again. But that's just... I mean, that's flat out, straight up Gibson.
Is when you go into production with this?
I heard when I was speaking to him last time, he says I'd like to be gone, and he gave me a certain date by that particular time.
You're not going
to
give it to us.
Well,
that's fine. I'm not looking for a scoop.
But no, he just said I'd like to be going at this particular time. But see, this is the 1, 2, 3. He's on the fourth draft of the script.
Is it an Aramaic?
So I started talking to him about this 5 years ago, and nothing was mentioned. Then last year, both Randall Wallace, who has been writing the script, they wrote Braveheart together.
Yeah, yeah.
And just smart to guy. Show you how hard it is, that blueprint is everything. And then now he's on the fourth draft of this thing. So he finally broke it. That's why I'd never said anything about it, but he finally figured it out. It's kind of like Thomas Edison. Gets to the end, and you go through the alphabet. So by way of analogy, he starts at A, he gets to Z, and then he goes, oh my gosh, I figured it out. But now he has to go back to A and start all over again. Yeah. But he's finally figured it out.
Jim, good to see you. Thank you so much. The movie opens up this Friday. It is Paul, Apostle of Christ, starring Jim Caviezel. You don't want to miss it. It is opening in theaters everywhere. It is paulmovie.com. All right, another twist on identity tax fraud. Thieves are hacking online accounts at tax preparation firms. Isn't that good? They can file phony refunds from, you know, the tax preparation firm, except it's not really from there. Once the IRS deposits money into the hacked client's bank accounts, the crooks contact them, posing as collection agencies, claiming the refund was an error in demanding payment. Unfortunately, people are falling for it. There are so many threats in today's connected world that you really need. All it takes is one small breach and it's over. So the new LifeLock is here. Now, the new LifeLock Identity Theft Protection adds power of Norton Security to help you protect against threats to your identity and to your devices. And these are things that you're not easily going to be able to see or fix, but they can. If you have a problem, they have agents who work to fix it. Now, nobody can stop all cyber threats, prevent all identity theft, or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock now with Norton Security is able to uncover threats that you might otherwise miss. So go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK, 1-800-LIFELOCK. Use the promo code BECK for an additional 10% off your first year. It's promo code BECK at LifeLock.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Welcome to the program. Let's play a little. Let's play a little Ben Shapiro on how the media has covered the gun debate.
Where do you see the most egregious media bias right now?
Well, over the last 3 weeks, obviously the coverage of the gun debate has been absolutely egregious. I mean, I don't want to single out your network, but CNN's been pretty bad on this from a conservative perspective. The idea that when there's a mass shooting, that the media feel the necessity to put on TV not only survivors, but specific survivors, that there's a certain subset of survivors who make it on TV a lot, and there are certain other survivors who don't, and that they decide to single out certain events and not other events in order to make a particular case, or they allow certain people to go on TV and suggest that folks like Dana Loesch or people at the NRA are evil, don't care, they're terrorists, and there's no pushback from the anchors. You know, this sort of thing makes a lot of people on the right feel that the media are really using this as an opportunity to push gun control rather than objectively covering, you know, the legislative efforts that are going on in Washington, D.C.
So your view is it should be 50-50, even if most of the students are urging gun control measures? You want it to be 50-50 or
no? I think 80-20 would be fine. I mean, I think that anything but 95-5 would probably be a good thing. And I think that it's also pretty obvious that, listen, everybody, this is my opinion about journalism, everybody in journalism has their own political views. We all vote, obviously, or at least most of us do. And it's not a pleasant thing when people in the media pretend their political views are not influencing their coverage, okay, when it's so obvious that those political views clearly are influencing their coverage.
That is Ben Shapiro. And I love Ryan's. What, you think it should be 50-50? Well, isn't that what you wanted for talk radio? Seriously, wasn't that?
And that was the legal requirement.
That
for
was
talk
the
radio.
Legal requirement that everybody thought we should bring back the fairness doctrine. And I don't want the fairness doctrine. But to look at Ben Shapiro, who was not asking for the fairness doctrine, to like, is that a, that's crazy. No, that's what you wanted to do to talk radio. I'm sorry, you don't like it for yourself? And Ben is right. All we want is just, if you got an opinion, say that's who you are. And here's an opinion. We balance it this way. I don't have a problem with MSNBC. They don't hide.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.